I have dictated this thing with long intervals in between. And as I played it over today, I realized that there may be some duplication. And also, I've left out a few things that I might add at this point. Also, one correction, because I want the thing to be accurate. I said that the Weyerhausers had a 20% interest in the Taubany Lumber Company and the Denkman Lumber Company. That isn't true. They had a 20% in the Edward Hines Lumber Company, which I later became committee chairman of when that got in trouble. That also worked out very well when business picked up after the Depression. I was telling some new neighbors the other day about the early days on Sunfish Lake. They seemed sort of interested in this episode, which I didn't mention when I was talking of some of the early days here. Fred Angel bought the farm at the end of the lake here from a man named Fairchild, who was an old settler in St. Paul. As a matter of fact, he was the father of Harry Fairchild, who was cashier of the First National Bank for many years. Well, Fairchild, mind weakened in his later years, and he used to go down on a dock that he had with a lot of chopped meat and throw it out, and it just used to swarm with bass. Old man Darzo told me this story. And he loved those bass. He was finally, I believe, foreclosed and had to get off the farm, or else Angel bought it from him, I don't know which. And he was so devoted to those fish that he couldn't bear to think of them, nobody taking care of them. So Darzo told me he bought some arsenic and threw quantities of it in the lake and killed every sign of life in the lake. So for some years there wasn't any fish life in the lake. Darzo thought it'd be nice to have some, so he said he went down in the Minnesota River and bought some carp minnows and threw them in. So when we came out here in 1929, the lake had lots of carp in it. If you'd get a very cold winter where the ice was thick and they didn't get too much oxygen, you'd find lots of dead carp on the shore. Well, I told about seining out the carp, where tons of them were taken out along with those turtles. But I forgot to mention this episode, which I thought was kind of interesting. Bob Anderson, who became Secretary of the Treasury, came into the Treasury just a couple of months before I did. Eisenhower didn't know him very well when he came in, but he formed quite an attachment for him. In fact, in the last two and a half years I was there, I think Bob Anderson spent perhaps 20-25% of his time over in the President's office. I think he was the closest advisor the President had, without any question. Well, I'd been down there perhaps a year and a half and seen the President a good deal. One time when I was over there to get his approval on a new piece of government financing, he said, "I wish you'd stay a minute. I want to talk to you." At that time, he said, "You know, I've taken a great fancy to Bob Anderson, and I have been trying to persuade him to show himself around the country, make some speeches. He's an excellent talker, and possibly be a candidate to succeed me in the presidency." But he said, "I haven't been able to make any impression on him." Now, he said, "I know you're closer to him than anybody else here in Washington, probably. And I wish you'd go to work on it and see if you could persuade him." Well, I did. I talked to Bob several times and urged him to do it. Well, he was always reluctant. He never gave me any real reason, but he didn't want to push himself, and so on and so forth. Well, in the last weeks we were in Washington, I went in and said this to him. I said, "Bob, I understand fully why you didn't want to make your face around the country and get in the presidential race." He said, "Why do you think?" Well, I said, "I found that you don't like administration," and he really didn't. He had no knack for that at all. He made an excellent speech. He was a fine thinker. If problems were presented to him, he could make one of the clearest expositions and with very sound answers. But he was too trusting. He believed everybody. He hated to criticize everybody, even when people fouled him up, as Doug Dillon did on two occasions. He would say, "Well, I just don't think he understands," and he didn't like a fight. And he would have had a rough time, I think, as president. I told the president that I had come to realize that he was not a all-around executive, that he had his real talents, very brilliant talents, but it didn't go to being a, certainly he would have not made a good president. Well, he said, "I'm interested to hear that. I never knew why he wouldn't do it either." It was after Bob had definitely turned him down that he began to think more of Nixon. The story was published that he really didn't like Nixon and so on and so forth. That wasn't true. He had the greatest admiration for Nixon, as I did. But I think he saw the same shortcomings in him. And he was very sincere in wanting Nixon to succeed him toward the end. He didn't make speeches for Nixon. I think that's when the press comments came that he wasn't for him, because he felt that he didn't want him go in as Papa's boy. He wanted him to stand on his own feet, and I think that was a wise decision. While I'm again talking about Eisenhower, I might say that a couple of years after I left Washington, I was in Washington one day and met Eisenhower in the corridor of the Mayflower Hotel. We stopped and talked a little. He said, I wish you'd come and see me sometime up at Gettysburg on the farm. And he said, when you're coming down east sometime, you let me know, and we'll make an appointment. Well, a few months later, I was going to Washington again and did make an appointment with him, and drove up to there and had a delightful hour and three quarters sitting out on the lawn looking at the Blue Ridge Mountains and reviewing a lot of things we'd gone through. Also, a little after that, he was getting out his two-volume book on his experiences in Washington, and he had showed some of it to Bob Anderson, and asked his help. And there were certain parts of this whole gold episode that I referred to that Bob wasn't too familiar with, and he sent quite a little of the manuscript to me and asked me if I would look it over and make any corrections. He did send it out to me, and I did make some corrections, some of which got in the final draft as the book was published, and some did not. Speaking of Nixon, I might enlarge a little bit on my impressions of Nixon. In a cabinet meeting, he sat across from the president. An agenda was presented, was given everybody before the meeting. You were supposed to do your homework. Some of the members of the cabinet didn't do it. By the way, there was a cabinet meeting there every Friday. Eisenhower really relied on his cabinet, as presidents since have not done. Well, at those meetings, the last one to speak was Nixon. Of course, he'd had the advantage of hearing the discussion around the table, and some of the comments were quite sharp. When it was through, the president had turned to Nixon and say, "Dick, now you've had a chance to listen to all this as I have. Now I'd like to have your conclusions." Well, instead of giving a quick, brief answer, he would often take 5 or 10 or even 15 minutes in a long lawyer's exposition of the pros and cons of the thing. And he would say, for instance, if we took Dulles' tack, that would seem very liberal, it would seem the easy thing to do at first. looks very promising, but doesn't it lead us into this kind of problem? And then on the other hand, if we took Lou Straw's position, it's a little tougher now, but doesn't it make it easier later? I'm just illustrating the type of thing. And when he got through, you think to yourself, why couldn't I think of those things? Because it was the clearest mind there. And I would say at least 3 times out of 4, probably more than that, Eisenhower would say, well, I was a little on the fence, Dick, but you've convinced me that's what we'll do. So I came away from Washington with the greatest respect for the brain of Dick Nixon. Dick had always done his homework, and with this very incisive mind, one of the best minds I've ever encountered, everyone in the cabinet had the greatest respect for him. His weakness was that he was interested in ideas and not people. And all this Watergate experience and what's happened when he became president brings out that trouble. He wants a little group around him of real intimates who. I think in many cases, perhaps Kissinger's the exception, tell him what he wants to hear. He's very secretive. In the last days of the Eisenhower administration, he and Bob Anderson didn't get on at all because Bob tried to interest him in this foreign situation that was causing us so much trouble, and he wasn't very much interested. We were taking a stand in the Treasury, and and Bill Martin at the Fed and his associates were taking a tight money stand because we had a bad inflation. And, of course, the other side made the most of that. And probably that contributed to Dick Nixon's defeat because, as you'll remember, it was just a fraction of 1% difference. And I think if the Eisenhower administration hadn't taken that stand, trying to check inflation by fiscal and monetary measures, that Kennedy would have been elected. Another episode in that connection, and this is jumping a number of years forward, toward the end of the, or about the middle part of the Johnson administration. Johnson was making these easy money speeches. I went over and had lunch one day with Walter Heller at the faculty club, and that was on a Monday. He'd just come back from Washington. He was a very free talker, and he told me a lot of what President Johnson had told him in a 2-hour-and-a-quarter conversation on the previous Saturday afternoon. He shouldn't have told me some of the things he did, but he really left the Council of Economic Advisors, I think. He was then out of it because he couldn't agree with some of Johnson's financial ideas. He called himself a populist, which meant he was for easy money and all that sort of thing. Well, when he left Washington, I'm talking about Walter Heller, he went up to Harvard shortly after and gave 2 endowed lectures. They called them the Godley Lectures, and he sent me the copies of them, of the material. I was delighted to find in one where he was bragging about how successful they'd been in the early 60s in controlling the economy, and there was a very small, healthy growth each year, and he took credit for it on this fine-tuning they were working at that time. That was the phrase for these small adjustments in the budget or the tax program or whatever it was, to make these fine-tuning adjustments. But he had one sentence, perhaps it was 2, in this first lecture, in which he said, of course, I have to admit, if it hadn't been for the rather drastic steps the Eisenhower administration took in the last year to control that inflation and get it under control, we couldn't have made the record we did. Well, later on, these two lectures, slightly edited and modified, were published in the form of a book, which I sent and got, and immediately thumbed over to where he talked about this thing I mentioned about his adjustments they'd made and how successful they were, and he omitted this sentence giving credit to the Eisenhower administration for what they'd done. And I saw him somewhere shortly afterward, and I said, "Walter, you remember you sent me the Godley lectures, and I paid you the compliment. I thought you were very objective in giving what credit to the Eisenhower administration for checking this inflation that was rampant in 1960 by the measures we took both in the monetary and the fiscal policy. Monetary policy wasn't the Eisenhower administration, it was the Federal Reserve, but he was giving credit to both. And I said, when I turned to your book, I hunted and hunted and hunted through it, and I couldn't find that reference." Well, he kind of blushed and then said, I didn't include it. He said, a lot of my friends were pretty critical of my bringing that up, and I thought it wouldn't make too much difference if I left it out. Well, it's a little criticism of his integrity, I think, to do that, because he knew perfectly well and had said that they couldn't have made the record they did in fiscal affairs in the first few years in the small inflation unless somebody had injected some discipline into the system. Now to go back to my last few weeks in Washington. After the election, Doug Dillon, who'd been named Secretary of the Treasury, came over and took a little office right across the hall from me and spent a good deal of time in my office and the Secretary's office going over what the problems were in the Treasury. The staff of the Treasury told us that we had prepared, and they'd helped us do it, the most elaborate briefing on all the problems that we were confronted with and how we recommended they be handled, both in the matter of dealing with this foreign gold situation and with debt management and so on. And we went over and over those things with Doug Dillon. Also after election, the president went up to Hyannis, spent a couple of weeks, and then on his way down to Palm Beach, where he spent the last few weeks before election, he stopped off in Washington and went in to see the President Eisenhower and asked him, now I wish you'd give me the benefit of any advice you have of what I should do when I get in. Well, the president, and this was reported being by Bob Anderson, who the president had then sent for to sit in the meeting, that their biggest problem was causing them the most grief was this loss of gold, this adverse balance of payments that was running so strongly against us. And he told the Kennedy that it had been very much aggravated by the speech he'd made out in Milwaukee, where he talked about taking away a lot of the independence of the Federal Reserve, and where Johnson had made a speech, and I think it was in Waco, Texas, but it was very widely reported, in which he said he believed in cheap money and the interest rates were too high and he was going to do all this sort of thing. That had caused great consternation in Europe. And when on October 21st, the Gallup poll, which had been predicting Nixon's election all the time from the convention on, switched and said it looked as if Kennedy was going to win by a small margin. There was almost a panic in the European chanceries. They thought it meant a inflationary movement and a cheap money movement in the United States, and from the 23rd, or 21st rather, of October until Election Day, I think there was something like $1.8 billion of gold flowed out of this country. What we were doing is pouring gold into the London free gold market to hold the price at $35 an ounce, because it had been the practice of the Treasury, not a contractual arrangement, ever since the Bretton Woods conference back in 1945, to be willing to pay out gold, $4, at $35 an ounce. And the loss of gold continued after the election. And the president-elect Kennedy named a man, his name has just slipped me now, and I knew him so well. He was an ex-professor of political economy at Johns Hopkins, and had been in the Navy Department. I think he was Assistant Secretary of the Navy under Truman. He was named to come into the Treasury, keep track of what was going on, and report to Kennedy. And he would come over to see either me or the Secretary. The Secretary happened to be out of town quite a little. He was in Europe at that time. And so he usually came in to see me about 2 o'clock every afternoon. He wanted to know how much gold we'd had to furnish to London. And then he would go and call up the president and tell him about this. So by the time the president took office, he was very much concerned about this problem. There's nothing we could do to stop it, because our voice meant nothing. It was the incoming people whose voice had to speak. One day this man I referred to, who was keeping track of what was going on in the Treasury, said, "Well, I realize this is a very serious thing, and what do you think should be done about it?" "Well," I said, "in the first place, you ought to appoint somebody here in the Treasury that has standing internationally and who's considered sound, and perhaps he could restore some confidence." "Well," he said, "we just put Doug Dillon in there, and he's competent, isn't he?" I said, "Not in this field. He's been in the State Department, and he was in Wall Street, but he doesn't know this international situation. I know that because I talk to him every day here, practically, and that doesn't do it at all. And, of course, you can't remove him now. He's been named, so you better put somebody in my job, would be the person who would deal mostly with these foreigners on this thing, and that might do some good. It's the only thing I can suggest, and the president will have to make some strong statements on it when he goes in." "Well," he said, "who should I put in?" "Well," I said, I don't want to give a name offhand. I'll think about it." Well, either the next day or the day after, when he came in again, I said, "I've been thinking it over. If you want a suggestion, I'll give you one." I said, "I've had a lot to do with Bob Rosa, who's in the Federal Reserve of New York, head of their foreign operations, and is well known to all the finance men in Europe, highly regarded. And I think if he were to be put in my job, it might help you solve the situation." And I said, "Don't take my word for it. You call Perry Jacobson, who's head of the International Monetary Fund, and Bill Martin of the Federal Reserve. They both know him well, and ask their opinion of him." Well, it turned out that he called Kennedy that same afternoon, and that same day, Bob Rosa was summoned down to Palm Beach and offered the job. He didn't want to take it. He said he wanted to think about it, and he called me up, and both Bob Anderson and I laid down on him pretty hard, and he did take it. The president by then had become thoroughly scared. That was by January 20th, and gold was still running out our ears. And so he listened to Bob Anderson, and listened to Bob Rosa, And Bob wrote a speech on the subject of the balance of payments and the loss of gold and so on. It was just a marvelous speech with all, said all the right things. He was for motherhood and everything that was sound financially. And Kennedy gave that speech, every word of which had been written by Bob Rosa, I think it was within 2 weeks after he went into office. And from then on, things began to quiet down. And Bob Rosa was a real tower of strength, and the gold run stopped. If it hadn't stopped, they had to do what was done here 2 years ago, that when they suspended redeeming dollars at with gold at $35 an ounce. Sometime later, when I was in Washington, there were several of us in an elevator in the Metropolitan Club, and one of the men with me started to introduce me to this man who I said had come in the Treasury as Kennedy's agent to report to him what was going on. And the introduction was, I want you to meet Julian Baird. He's the only man in the who selected his own successor in the last administration. And I know he did that because I was party to it, he said. I stayed in Washington till the afternoon of Inauguration Day because we had so many irons in the fire, we had to keep things going right up to the last minute. I left, I think, on the last airplane that got out of Washington about the middle of that afternoon, and you'll remember the whole inauguration functions were snarled by streets piled high with snow where people couldn't get around and all that sort of thing. When I got home, the bank had decided to make me again the chairman of the board in an advisory way because Phil had been running the bank for over 3 years and doing it extremely well. And so I was very happy to continue in my old office as a chairman for a couple of more years. After that, I moved on upstairs, occupied a number of different offices, had my old... The first move was up to the sixth floor, the office I'd occupied for many years before I went downstairs to the main bank in about 1934, I believe it was. Miss Spink was still there, but she was in failing health and died within a year after that. She'd been with me for nearly 40 years and knew everything about me and all my friends and could write a great many letters for me, but she was not as able as this Miss Alexander in Washington, who was the ablest person I'd ever had work under me in a secretarial capacity. Since then, I've had many part-time secretaries who answer the phone, make appointments, and that sort of thing for me, and Gertrude Matthews came to me, I think it must have been about 1963, as a part-time secretary to keep my books and pay my bills and so on. She comes in, since she's come in every Tuesday and Thursday morning, and has done a fine job for me. She's a splendid little woman. I hope we can keep her as long as either Helen and I are able to function, because she's a great help to both of us. This, I mentioned earlier that I was given credit for picking my own successor in the Treasury, and I really think it was fortunate at that time because he, as I said before, he did a great job. Come to think that there's one other experience I had after I left Washington that might be recounting, because I think I also had a good deal to do with making Hubert Humphrey vice president under Johnson. That may seem a little surprising, but here was the course of events. in the summer of 1960, about 2 weeks before the, well, several weeks before the Democratic Convention, I was in Washington in a meeting of the Government Borrowing Committee. And the Government Borrowing Committee, as I said before, was a very distinguished group of very prominent bankers, heads of a lot of the largest banks in the country, who met prior to every financing. We had having dinner one night, and after dinner we got talking politics, and somebody said what a terrible tragedy it'd be if Hubert Humphrey were named as vice president. Because all of the gossip in the newspapers won that it was going to be either Wagner of New York, Brown of California, or Hubert Humphrey. Well, I chimed in and said this, that I'd known Hubert for a good many years. Not awfully well, but had plenty of chance to size him up. And I'd never voted for him and never would. That he was the kind of fellow that would say anything on his way up that slippery flagpole to get prominence, but and if it get him votes, but that he really was a fairly sound fellow in many ways. I knew from my own acquaintance with him that he knew quite a little about this international monetary situation, and I'd given him quite a few talks on and government borrowing and some of the problems we had. As a matter of fact, he'd agreed one time that he would support us on getting off this 4.25% ceiling on all government bonds, which had been with us for many years and was causing a lot of havoc. He said he'd go with me if I could convince Walter Heller. Well, I thought I could do that, and I asked him to come down, and he spent a morning with Walter and convinced him that he ought to support it. And he said, well, it's sort of hard for me because all my liberal friends in the Senate feel otherwise. But he said, you convinced me, and I'll talk to Hubert about it. After that, Hubert said he'd give me support, and he didn't vary at all on it. So I had some respect for his word. And I thought he was very smart. And I said to this crowd, I said, actually, if he once was elected to the presidency, he knows enough about government affairs, and is that I think he began to think of his what his record would be, how it would look some years later. And I don't think he'd be too radical. I said, I'm not advocating him. I don't want to see him in there, but as against either Wagner or Brown, who are just economic non-entities, I think he's the better choice. Well, after the meeting, Dave Kennedy came to me and he said, I was interested in what you said about Hubert. I've never met him. Will you take me up to the Capitol to meet him? And I said, yes. So the next morning I called up and made an appointment. And we went up and had a half-hour talk in the reception room off the Senate with Hubert. And Dave was quite taken with him. And he asked him, he said, I'd like to give a dinner for you out in Chicago, which he did. And he told me he had about 100 people there, and Hubert made a pretty good impression. Well, I repeated this to call Bob Anderson on the phone and told him about this. And he said, well, I know Hubert, and I think you're right. Of those three, there's no question that Hubert is much the safer and more competent man. And I'll do the same thing for him in New York. So he gave a meeting for him in New York and had, I think, 75 or 100 of the leading businessmen in New York there. And Hubert, again, as he could made a very good impression. Well, Bob Anderson was seeing Johnson quite frequently because they were old Texas friends, and he tried to give him some good advice, which Johnson constantly asked for but seldom took. And Johnson said, well, I can't appoint Hubert. The business community would rise up in their wrath. They're all against him. And he told about these two meetings that where he made a good impression. And Johnson, who always believed that a few people ran the country, said, well, now if somebody like head of the Steel Corporation, oh, what's his name? I'll think of it in a second here. How would he feel about it? Well, he said, Bob had said, I think he'd feel the way. And also the man who's president of the telephone company. Getting 81 years old, these names slip me that I know so well. I'll think of them all sometime in the middle of the night. And Bob told me he mentioned those two people. And he said, I think I better stay out of this, but would you call them up? And I said, yes, I knew them, and I would, and I called them up, and I was very careful. I said, now, here's a funny story for me. I have a lifelong Republican. I wouldn't vote for Hubert Humphrey for vice president, of course, but of these three people, he is so much the better, and I think you both know him, and perhaps you will agree. Well, they both thought perhaps he was. And I said, here's the what Johnson would love to hear is a report from you two men that you think he's the better man of the three. Well, I found out later that the Steel Corporation man did call Johnson and told him that. I never heard whether the telephone man did or not. He may have done it. Well, so much for that part of the story. I was in Washington for a government borrowing committee again about 2 weeks before the Democratic convention, which was held in Atlantic City that year. This again, the papers were full of the fact that who would one of these three men I named, Brown, Wagner, or Hubert Humphrey, would be tagged as vice president. Well, I had a telephone call. It was from Bob Anderson. He was in Washington. He said, I've just come from the president's office. And this may stun you, he said, but he asked me if I would get in touch with Hubert Humphrey and tell him I'm going to pick him. No, I'm a little erring that. He said, I'd like to get the word to Hubert Humphrey that he's picked. He's going to be the man. Well, Bob said, why don't you tell him? Well, I don't want to appear. Johnson loved this mystery and devious dealing. And he said, I don't want you to do it, Bob, because people know you see me a great deal, and it might be traced back. And who could I use? Well, Bob said, you remember Julian Baird that was undersecretary under me, and he knows Hubert Humphrey very well, and he is the one that stimulated this Chicago and New York meetings for Hubert. And, Johnson said, is he trustworthy? Will he leak this? And he said, no, he won't leak it if I ask him to. I have implicit confidence in him, and so on and so forth. He said, all right, you ask him to see Hubert and tell him that. Bob had said, I was in Washington there for a meeting at that time. Well, he said, you see him and ask him to tell Hubert. So, well, I said, this is a funny thing. You want me to do it, do you, Bob? Yes. Well, it happened by coincidence that we had some senator who was going to speak at a dinner. We always invited somebody into one of those when we were down there for one of these government boring committees. Some prominent person come in and talk at dinner, and they'd ask some man he couldn't be there, and they just asked Hubert Humphrey. I think, matter of fact, Dave Kennedy probably instigated that because he wanted this other crowd to see him too. And so when we went into the dinner, Hubert and his administrative assistant, Collins, I think it was, was with him, and I got them both, and I said, when this meeting's over, I'd like to sit in the corner and talk to you for 5 minutes. I've got something I think you'll be interested in. So when it was over, I told them, I said, now, I'm a reporter. I have no confidence in Johnson at all. I know he's lied 3 times once to the secretary and me, and twice later to the secretary, and I won't vouch for this being the fact, but I'm told to tell you this. I told him these circumstances. He said the president wants the word to go to you that you are going to be the vice president, not presidential nominee. Now, I wouldn't trust him farther than you throw a bulb of the tail, but I've done my duty, and I've told you. Well, they were both rather stunned, and I've never seen Hubert since but what he comments on that thing. I saw him, he gave a sermon at House of Hope Church about 3 months ago, and it was Father's Day, and his first 30 minutes were just splendid. He talked about his own father, it was excellent taste, and then he went on for another 35 minutes repeating old political speeches and tearing in the administration. He just could not shut off. After church, I went in the parish house and shook hands with him, and we commented on this, that I probably had something to do with making him vice president, and I said, I don't think I did you any service, Hubert. He said, if it hadn't been for your being fouled up with Johnson, who ended up so terribly unpopular, I said, you might have been elected president. And so I don't think I did you any service at all by working for you for the vice presidency. Well, he said, it's a great experience. And that's where that ended. Well, I think I've covered the waterfront pretty well. If I think of some other things later, I may add to this. Some time has elapsed since I last dictated this tape, and I did remember there was another episode that I think is worth recording. It was one of the real most dramatic things I've ever been mixed up with. That had to do with the police department. St. Paul, in 1933, was kind of the national headquarters of kidnappings. Bill Hamm was kidnapped, Bramer was kidnapped, and they tried to kidnap Dick Lilly at the golf course. The car was parked along the Jefferson Highway, and as he was going down that hole, going south from, I think it was the 16th hole in those days, he saw that car and some men come through the brush along the side. He was suspicious and excused himself and went back to the clubhouse. Later on, he did learn when the kidnappers were caught that they did try to get him, but he got away from them. Well, the whole town was nervous. A number of people, for instance, Shreve Archer and Charlie Ward, had armor plate around their automobiles, and carried a revolver in the front seat with them. We've always had people come in and drive around our circle here, and we never thought much about it, but we were all jittery at that time. And so I went down to Kennedy Brothers and bought 3 old 12-gauge shotguns, had them sawed off, had one in my bedroom and one in Frank's room, which was then, he was then our houseman and was lived in that bedroom off the kitchen. And I had another one up the barn. Well, they were awful old guns, and the mechanism was apparently pretty well worn out. But anyway, the one in Frank's bedroom fell over, and it was, of course, loaded, and it discharged and just missed him by a hair, but blew a hole in the radiator. And we had a real flood because practically all the water in the system ran out there where the radiator was broken. At that time, Ned Warren was police commissioner. He was an automobile dealer in St. Paul and a very honest fellow. And he became suspicious that there was something wrong in the police department. There had been an old tradition in St. Paul of protecting racketeers and bad characters if they behaved themselves in St. Paul. Back at the turn of the century, Dick O'Connor was the political boss of the town, and John O'Connor's brother was police commissioner. And for a couple of decades, there was sort of an understanding that any crooks that wanted to come to town, if they registered in with the police department, they wouldn't be disturbed here, as long as they pulled their jobs in Chicago or Milwaukee or Minneapolis or somewhere else. So that old tradition held. Well, Ned Warren, as police commissioner, became suspicious that there was something funny about this kidnapping here, and it later did develop that some of the police were actually tipping off some racketeers, the Carpus gang, as to who they should kidnap, and presumably some money passed on the whole thing. We never could prove that. But anyway, the police department was pretty crooked. Well, Ned Warren went to Howard Kahn, who then was editor of the Daily News, and they went to Dick Lilly and said, couldn't they get some fund together to try to clean up the town? Well, Dick arranged through Senator Kellogg to have an interview with Hoover of the FBI in Washington. Now, the FBI has always been very hesitant to get in any local police affairs. They didn't want to be considered a national police force. But through Senator Kellogg's introduction, Hoover did tell them that if they would hire a young fellow who recently graduated from the Northwestern University Crime School, that he might be able to do something, but they would need quite a little money if they were going to carry on a real investigation. Well, to make a long story short, Dick raised about $86,000, mostly among the directors of the First National Bank. And Howard Kahn and Ned Warren went down to Chicago and interviewed this Wallace Jamie and hired him to come up here. Well, Ned Warren took him under his wing and had him around the police department, kind of making a fool of himself. It was this kind of an amateur Sherlock Holmes running around with a reading glass looking at fingerprints and one thing another. And he was quite a joke in the police department. But actually, he got in some good licks. He hadn't been there more than a couple of months before he had got the head electrician in the police department to put taps on, I think it was 11 telephones of the senior police officers in the department. And he had those taps recorded on platters. They didn't have tape at that time. They were platters, as I remember, about 16 inches in diameter. And the machine that recorded was down in the basement somewhere. And I don't know how he ever worked it, but he had some girl that would go down there and listen to various telephone conversations. And if it looked interesting, she'd switch it on this platter and it'd be recorded. The thing went on for 14 months. And then the police began to get suspicious. By that time, they had a stack of platters, as I remember. It was about 2 feet tall. About every other Saturday afternoon, some of us would meet. By that time, they'd brought in Bill Oppenheimer as a lawyer to advise us on this thing. Ned Warren, this Wallace Jamie, and myself would meet in Howard Kahn's room. He was an old bachelor that lived in the athletic club. And he would play us some of the more juicy records. Well, it was quite a gruesome story. The police were taking a good deal of money. It started with gambling, and the FBI told us at that time that's where it usually starts. The public isn't much outraged at gambling. And in fact, now, of course, a good many states allow open gambling on racetracks and all those. So nobody was particularly outraged that there was gambling going on. And there were two places where you could make these bets. One was on 7th Street, just below Wabashaw, the second floor of a building there, and the other was on Wabashaw, right near 7th. And at that time, the FBI told us that this betting was all controlled in Philadelphia. And all of these bets would be wired in from around the country to there, and then they would send the word out to the track and what horses they wanted to win. We learned at that time from the FBI that at that time there were only three honest tracks in the United States. One was Santa Anita, which had just been started at that time. Another was the other two were down around New York. I've forgotten the names, but they're still operating. Most of these other smaller tracks were all crooked and in this gambling syndicate. Well, of course, once the police got taking money for protecting this gambling, obviously the man on the beat knew what was going on, then it spread to other things like prostitution and dope and keeping saloons open after the closing hours and all that sort of thing. Well, a lot of the conversations recorded on these platters were very interesting. Of course, when you get a crooked situation like that, it's hard to keep the people operating honest between themselves. They had to use a lot of patrolmen as collectors from these places, and then the higher-ups would feel some of them were holding out on them, which they were, and then there'd be a lot of a pretty savage conversation between them, and they would have to move police from one beat to another, so they had the ones they could trust to turn over a reasonable amount to the higher-ups. So, some very interesting conversations that we heard over this 14 months before finally Bill Oppenheimer thought we had plenty of evidence to go to court. We had to have it iron-bound because we had some suspicion that the district attorney at that time, an old political operator, was less than enthusiastic about prosecuting anything like this, and there had to be public pressure to do it. When we finally sprung the thing, Howard Kahn had these streamlined headline stories right across the top of his front page for, I think it was between 2 and 3 weeks, exposing some of these tapes. But we had to be careful that there wasn't any that we were going to use as evidence later, so some of the best tapes were held out. But there was enough to shock the whole public. By the way, Howard Kahn, for this expose, got the Pulitzer Prize that year for investigative reporting. The town was naturally quite shocked by these exposures. As could be expected, the district attorney had to put this evidence before the grand jury. As I remember it, the chief, Culligan, resigned. He wasn't quite definite whether he was in the racket or not. Several others resigned. Several were indicted, and I think, if I'm correct, that two of them were sent to the state penitentiary. Well, that caused a complete shakeup of the police department. Gus Barfus, who was, I think, one of the higher officers in the police department, a captain, I believe, was the only one who came through, of the top officers, who came through absolutely clean. Result was that he was made chief, and a year or two later, he was elected for a couple of terms as commissioner and assigned as commissioner of police. We all thought he was so good that some of us thought we'd run him for Congress. And we put up some money, and he absolutely fell flat. He had no ability to speak at all, and it was just a gross error on our part to think his popularity, always leading the ticket for commissioner, would also prevail when he ran for Congress, but it did not. Well, this resulted in a complete shakeup of the police department. Nearly all the higher officials in the police department had to step out. Barfus told us that the way he really cleaned the place up was to put the fear of God in everybody in the department. There were a lot of the patrolmen and lower ranks that had been collectors on this scheme that had been going on, and a lot of others knew about it. He got each of the shifts of the police department personnel together and gave them a talk, and he exaggerated what we had on them. He told them we had a great deal on them, and we did have a lot on these platters, but he didn't blame them all if their superiors were crooked. Why, perhaps there was too much temptation, but if he wasn't going to fire them all, but if they'd go on and be honest from here on, they could stay on. But he, anytime anybody stepped over the line, he had plenty of evidence to throw them out or send them to penitentiary. And the result was that the FBI, who we kept in touch with for many years, said that as far as they could see, that everything was very clean here in St. Paul. I don't think there was much doubt but what the police were actually in on the kidnappings that had been taking place. The Dillinger gang and the Carpus gang both hung out here. The Dillinger crowd were in two apartments in that apartment building on the corner of Lexington and Goodrich Avenue, just a half a block from the Summit School, and lived there very quietly for a good many months. The police certainly knew they were in town and made no effort to bother them, apparently, and I guess we're tipping them off on these who to kidnap. In fact, Bramer was kidnapped just practically outside that building in front of Summit School. Probably the most important thing that this cleanup accomplished was the fact that we got a bill through the legislature which created a new means of selecting a police chief instead of being just appointed by the police commissioner or the city council, I don't remember which. There was a citizens committee that made three nominations, and then the mayor, I believe, could select from among those three the police chief. So we kept politics out of it pretty well, and the FBI told me not long ago that was probably the greatest accomplishment we had had, and that's why we've been able to keep the town clean. About every couple of years I'd have lunch with the local FBI people, and they'd tell me whether they thought the town was clean. One time there was some suspicion, there was some hanky-panky going on. We brought in an outside investigator and cleaned that situation up very shortly. When we got finished the investigation, we had spent only about two-thirds of our money. We had some left. And since then, that has been used from time to time to buy certain equipment for the police department or other ways to accomplish better law enforcement. And that has been a great help to the police department, they tell us. Minneapolis had been known that time and for a good many years after as a wide-open town. Kid Can and his gang controlled the vice in the town. They owned a lot of liquor licenses. They controlled the prostitution, the gambling, and so on. And sometime after our expose in St. Paul, Don Dayton, who was a good friend of mine, asked me how we cleaned up St. Paul. Well, I said I'd be glad to tell him. And so he invited me over to lunch and had, I think it was four other leading citizens, all of whom I knew in Minneapolis. And I told him the whole story of St. Paul, how he did it. And I said I thought it could be done again if they really wanted to clean it up. Well, some time passed and I saw Don Dayton again. And I said, how are you coming on that? Well, he said, Julian, he was quite shamefaced about this. He said, when it came right down to it, my other friends there thought it'd be a bad thing to do in Minneapolis. We're a great convention town, and you had to have some late-night entertainment for these people, and they didn't want the town cleaned up, and so the whole thing was dropped. Of course, Wallace Jamie's usefulness was through once this expose was made in the newspaper and in the and we had the indictments and convictions and so on. Well, he was offered a job to go to Los Angeles, which had a very dirty situation. Some of you may remember the name Bugsy Siegel, who was the vice boss of that Los Angeles at that time. At that time, the big newspaper there seemed to be, and a reform mayor seemed to be in favor of trying to clean up the town. So they hired Wallace Jamie as a secret agent. Well, a year later, I was going out to California, and I wrote to Wallace Jamie, told him I was going to be out there, I'd like to see him. Well, he said he'd like to see me and he'd like to show me some things. Well, he met me and arranged that I was to go